Last night we talked about Revelation 13 and some of the prophecies that tell us what we can expect to see in our world, as portrayed by Daniel in Daniel 12 and Jesus in his discussions with his disciples, and then in Revelation chapter 13 as we discuss some of the problems that an end time world will face. Now, what we saw were some kind of sobering predictions about the future of our world, economically and militarily and geopolitically. When this cosmic war finally winds up, it won't end easily. It'll be a tough time. But the nice thing about the Bible is, it not only tells you frankly what you can expect to see and the challenges you'll see, it also gives you good news and a plan to follow. And as Captain Joe would tell you, if you have a chart that tells you where the channel is, where the reefs are, and how you get safely from here to there, it makes all the difference in the world. And I can relate to that. I've been a naval officer myself and conned warships in and out of some pretty narrow places. So narrow that, as a matter of fact, to the right hand and the left hand of the ship, you could see shoal water building up. You really had to stay in the channel. Well, the Bible gives us a plan by which to do that. So not only do we know what's coming in terms of problems in the world, the Bible also gives us advice as to how to get through that time. It has advice for people living just before Jesus returns. And now we're ready to open the Word. We were in Revelation 13 last night. We're just going to move up one chapter and go to Revelation 14. And Revelation 14 begins in the first verse with a picture after the war is over. And you see, and just a numberless host of the redeemed standing on what John calls a sea of glass. I am convinced that what that is that diamond-paved assembly ground where the angels assemble in front of the throne. So get the picture now. What's happening in Revelation 14, verse 1. Ezekiel looked into the heart of heaven. He saw this just enormous, towering throne made out of what appeared to be the gemstone sapphire. Sapphire is a gorgeous royal blue. It has pyrite streaks through it so that it's a kind of a mixture of blue and gold color. And sapphire is really interesting. You can heat that chemical, like that rock, in a crucible until it glows, it incandescens, and it never loses that gorgeous blue color. That's the throne of God. The thing soars high, high above this assembly ground. On top of that blue and gold throne is this shattering light. That is the cosmic king. And around that, for probably what are earthly miles, is this gemstone paved floor, this diamond paved floor where the angels gather. And now in Revelation 14, the chapter begins with the redeemed there on that place before that throne. The war's over and they're home and there's peace again in the cosmos. First five verses of Revelation 14 describe that group of incredibly happy and blessed people before the throne of God, and then, as prophecy often does, it takes you a ways, and then it brings back another subject and tells you how all of this happened. So Revelation 14, 1 through 5, shows the redeemed in heaven after the war is over. Then starting with verse 6, it tells how they got there. And now we're ready for Revelation 14, 6, a series of messages designed to prepare people for the advent. They're just kind of like a stairway. Each one builds toward the one that follows. Each one rests on the one before. It's like a stairway that leads you upward, so that by the time you get to the 14th verse of Revelation 14, you have a word picture of the second coming. The whole sky is filled with fiery light, and there are so many angels, they just seem to be a sky-filling cloud. And in the center of that dazzling living mass of living beings, enthroned and crowned, is His Majesty, the Cosmic King. And when He speaks, even dead people can't sleep through it. And the whole wonderful story begins in verse 6. Revelation 14, 6. And I saw another angel fly in the midst of heaven, having what? The everlasting gospel to preach to them that dwell on the earth. The Greek word that's used for angel is agalos. And that doesn't necessarily mean an angel as we think of an angel from heaven. It more is translated the term messenger. And in early parts of Revelation, there are messages to the various churches in Turkey, what is modern-day Turkey. And it always says to the angel of the church of Laodicea or Thyatira or Sardis, I have the following message. Well, heaven isn't sending a message to angels necessarily. The term agalos in Greek really means messenger. Many times it almost implies the term pastor. So as we see in Revelation 14, 6, says, I saw another angel. Basically, what Revelation is saying is, I saw another messenger. And the message is so dramatic, it's as if an angel is proclaiming this from mid-heaven to a waiting world, and that angel has the everlasting what? Everlasting gospel. Now, we're going to see a series of messages like a stairway leading from the last moments on earth to the coming of Christ. And interesting, isn't it? They all begin with the gospel. Everything that God's people have to say at the end of time starts on the foundation stone of the gospel. In other words, before a person can look forward to seeing Jesus, he or she needs to know Jesus. Gospel is the foundation of everything we have to say. Now, we could just go right on now, kind of nod piously at each other and agree that, yes, the gospel is pretty foundational. But I'd like to suggest it means a whole lot more if we define what we just said. What is the gospel? And we can use these terms, but it's kind of nice to let the Bible enlarge on what it's saying. So what is the gospel? It's good news. That's exactly right. Might I suggest, when you encounter a question like that, go back to the Word for yourself. Don't listen to a commentator. Don't read a commentary. Go to the Word and let the Word interpret itself for you. And if you're going to do Bible research, might I suggest the first place you want to start looking is Calvary? Because most of the time, you're going to find your answer there. And I think that's the case here. Best illustration I can think of the gospel is that guy on the cross. We don't even know his name. All we've got is his rap sheet. He's a thief. He's a convicted thief. And in those days, they played the game seriously. You get convicted of thievery, you're crucified. So he's thrown down on his back on the splintery, upright stipes beam of a Roman cross. And a tough Roman knee comes down on his wrist to make sure his arm doesn't move. Then those 7-inch spikes are brought out, the hammer starts to ring, and then the pain begins. Because when that hand-forged Roman spike comes down and crushes the sensory motor median nerve in the wrist or the hand, it just sends jolts of fiery electric pain up the arm. You've encountered that in a mild form if you've ever bumped your elbow against the corner of a desk. But this didn't quit. That nerve was flattened. The pain just went on. Both arms, both legs, same thing happened in the legs. And a crucified individual usually just started to scream. There was no stopping it. The pain was just beyond description. And they would scream, and society had done the worst it could for them, so they had nothing left to lose, and they would usually start cursing everybody and everything from the Emperor of Rome on down. And this man did that for a while. They'd curse each other, and this man was cursing at Jesus, cursing at the Carnifex, cursing at the soldiers who drove the nails through his hands. And then he looks over at another cross, and what does he see? He sees a man who's in the same pain he's in, but he's not cursing. What does he hear instead? Baruch ata Adonai Eloheinu melech haolam, blessed Father, King of the universe, forgive. And something clicks in that thief's mind. Maybe a Torah extract he'd heard in synagogue, maybe the 22nd Psalm that his mom had read him or recited to him. Maybe he was exposed to Isaiah's prediction of a suffering Messiah. Something clicks in his mind. He gets it. The one hanging next to me is Israel's dream Messiah. That thief does three things. Number one, confesses his own unworthiness. Number two, confesses the righteousness of Christ. And number three, having admitted he doesn't deserve salvation, he asks for it anyway. And gets it. That, my friends, is the gospel. Now, we can complicate that with four-syllable theological terms, but at bottom, it's just that simple. That is the gospel. Confess the righteousness of Christ, confess your own unworthiness, and just ask to be saved. That's all it takes. So that thief gets salvation that morning, and so that, I recommend to you, is what we're talking about when Revelation 14:6 is the whole journey of an end-time group of people on the way to heaven consists of people starting with the foundation stone of the gospel. And that's something I suggest you can preach in Cannibal Valley or Wall Street. It's equally applicable either place. We don't deserve salvation, but we get it anyway. But the next question we want to ask is that all there is to it? Or might there be more? In other words, was forgiveness all that thief got? Or did knowing Jesus change his life? Now, he's still hanging there. He's still crucified. Those nerves are still on fire. The natural inclination is to keep on cursing, but the Bible doesn't record that he cussed anymore. Not after getting salvation from Jesus. So a lot of people say the gospel is good news, and it is. It's good news, but may I suggest, if that good news you get of salvation doesn't change your life, it's only good news for you. It may not be good news for your wife or your neighbor or even for your dog. The gospel needs to change your life. It doesn't stop there. It begins there. So Revelation 14's end-time messages begin with the gospel, but they don't end there. Now, in the era of Martin Luther, when people had become a little confused, perhaps, as to just what it took to be saved, whether it was faith or works or something else, that was present truth. But for an end-time world about to see the face of God and face Earth's terminal challenges, there's more that heaven has to share with us. So now we go back to Revelation 14:6. And Revelation 14 predicts not only events on earth, but events in heaven. As events on earth are racing like a train toward a train wreck, there are major events happening in heaven as well. And now we're ready to go back to verses 6 and 7. And I saw another angel fly in the midst of heaven, having the everlasting gospel, and verse 7, saying with a loud voice, "Fear God and give glory to Him, for the hour of His judgment is come." Notice the tense? Present tense. It is no longer future. It's come. It's here. It's happening now. Now, from the dawn of human history, good people of faith have known that one day there would be a judgment. That's been pretty clear. Abraham, sitting in the door of his tent that afternoon, begging for the survival of a wicked place called Sodom. He knew, ultimately, he was talking with the God of heaven when it finally came through that those three visitors that looked like human beings were anything but just ordinary human beings. And Abraham argues with the Lord. He's praying for the safety and continued mercy of a place called Sodom. And in Genesis 18, verses 23 to 25, he says, that'd be far from you to kill, to allow the death of the innocent with the guilty, to slay the righteous with the wicked. And then he raises an argument even God cannot respond to. He says, "Shall not the judge of all the earth do right?" He recognizes he's in the presence of the one who will judge the earth. He knew there would be a day of judgment. A Hebrew, a man of faith, I should say, a hero of faith named Job, foresaw judgment. And in Job 19, he said, "Be afraid of the sword, that ye may know there is a judgment." David, who really did need God's mercy after doing some awful things, spoke of the judgment in the Psalms. And his son Solomon, reflecting on the mistakes of his life, looked back and put it this way in Ecclesiastes 12. He said, "Fear God and keep his commandments, for this is the whole duty of man, for God shall bring every work," where? "Into judgment." So for the very morning of human history, people have known the day of judgment was coming. But now in Revelation 14, 6, and 7, suddenly it's in the present tense, a mighty message from the throne to the messenger of God's final messages to the world, says, "Fear God and give glory to him, for the hour of his judgment is come." It's here. Now, the interesting thing is that mathematically, the very moment when the judgment began can be computed. Not the date of the advent. Only the Father knows when Jesus is coming, but the day when judgment began in preparation for an end time world can be computed. We don't have time this morning to go into it, but those mighty prophecies of Daniel that accurately predicted the very year when Jesus would begin his ministry, the very year of his crucifixion, the very year of death of the first Christian martyr, also span across 2,300 years of time, burying themselves in a date not that distant from where we are today, and they foretell the actual moment when judgment will begin. So Revelation predicted an end-time message when people would announce to the world the judgment has begun. The judgment has to begin before the coming of Jesus because in Revelation 14, 6, and 7, it'll be several verses before we have a word picture of the advent. What we have is a picture of things going on in this world when the judgment begins. We don't have time to compute that this morning, but for serious Bible students, it's possible to do. Well, the judgment has begun, and for a lot of Christians, that's really scary news. You know? A lot of people, many people have visualized God as this stern being up on that towering blue and gold throne, looking down at this line of people waiting to get into heaven, hoping to get there, looking down at them and saying, "Well, you want in here, do you? Well, you may not make it. If you don't get in, I won't be surprised. Most people don't. But if you don't make it, there are plenty of folk behind you in line." That is a picture many Christians have of God. Might I suggest that that may just be one of Lucifer's greatest successes because it's hard to love a being like that. Giving us that picture of God may have been one of Lucifer's greatest successes. So let's go back and take another look at the judgment and see if it's bad news or good. In the judgment, guess who is your judge? It is not some stern, unloving being on a lofty throne staring down at you and telling you your chances are slim, if that good. Who's your judge? What did Jesus say? John 5:22, "For the Father judges no man, but has committed all judgment unto whom? Unto the Son." Now think about that for a second. You're being judged by somebody willing to die for you. A divine man who has been here, who's felt that riptide pull of temptation, who knows what it feels like to have nails driven through your hand and feel those fiery jolts of pain, who knows what it is like to stand in Sanhedrin Hall and see the most magnificent system of justice that I find in all of human history, mutilated because that body of 71 elders in Israel whose task it was to serve as defense counsel for anyone who was confused, instead turn into a kangaroo court and bend the Hebrew system of justice to secure your conviction. He's been here. He knows what it's like here. May I suggest, in the whole glittering universe, only He is fit to judge you. Only He's been here. Only He knows what it's like. Only He is fit to judge you. I say it with respect, but I mean it. The Father doesn't even try. Judgment belongs to that cosmic hero by the name of Jesus. Well, that ought to be reasonably good news, don't you think? You're judged by your Redeemer, but it gets even better than that, because He's not only your judge, He's something else. Now, John the Apostle wrote in 1 John chapter 2, "My little children, these things I write unto you, that you sin not." That's the ideal of the Christian faith. The ideal of the Christian faith isn't to figure out a theological way we can get comfortable with sin. The ideal is you don't mess with it, it'll kill you. Sin is not something you play with. So John espouses that ideal. "My little children, these things I write that you don't sin." But then he adds, "And if," not when, but "if any man sin, we have an advocate." Now, what's an advocate? An advocate is defense counsel. That's your defense attorney. Now, you think about that. In human law, if a judge knows you, has been your friend, has ever represented you, it is that judge's job to recuse himself or herself, get off the bench, if you're going to stand trial in front of that court. That'd be called conflict of interest. Yet heaven indulges in the greatest conflict of interest possible. Your judge is also your defense lawyer. Now, if heaven forbid you were ever charged with a crime, you go into court in whatever Florida county that happened in. The day before you were in your lawyer's office and he or she said to you, "I will do everything I can under Florida law to have you walk. You can walk on this. We can park a verdict for you." Having heard that assurance, you walk into court the next day, you look up at the bench, and guess who's up there in a black robe? Your defense attorney. Would you suddenly have a feeling of full assurance? Well, that's the heavenly judgment. Your judge is also your defense attorney. How are you going to lose a case like that? You can fire your defense counsel, but it wouldn't be real bright. So we have now an announcement from this messenger of heaven's end time truths that not only can we start with the gospel and rely on salvation, the good news is the judgment has begun. Your great defense attorney has taken the bench and he's issuing a verdict for your salvation. That's the good news of the judgment. Fear God and give glory to Him, for the hour of His judgment has come. But there's still more good news. Now we go back to Revelation 14, 6 and 7. "And I saw another angel fly in the midst of heaven, having the everlasting gospel, saying with a loud voice, fear God and give glory to Him." Then that messenger moves on with only a comma and the word and says, "Worship Him that made heaven and earth, the sea and the fountains of waters." One of the unique end time messages that heaven gives through that messenger to the world at the end of time is a reminder of the need to worship the Creator. Now, why would it be necessary at the end of time to remind people of that? Might it be that heaven could foresee a time when men would begin to try to forget they even had a Creator? And would come up with all kinds of fantastic ideas like, "Abigail, you can shake a sack full of sand and produce a puppy." Okay? Might heaven have foreseen the time when an entire world would be trying to forget that we're here because of intelligent design? The creation message is really important. It would come under attack by smart men who actually thought they knew what happened 5 billion years ago. And these same men, by the way, along with most of an astonished world, would soon encounter the Creator in regal majesty on that day of days when the war ends. Question is, why would nearly everyone come to doubt the clear evidence that we're not here by accident? Well, I think there's a reason. Because most people have forgotten the day that is the memorial of creation. A day God established at the end of creation week so we would never forget. The memorial was a day. He's done creating physical stuff. Now he moves into this abstraction called time. And out of time itself, he creates a temple. And he says, every 7 days I'll be here waiting for you so you will never forget how the world began. By the way, I haven't said it yet, but happy Sabbath. Y para nosotros que hablamos la boca del cielo, feliz sábado. Okay. At the end of creation week, God established a reminder. And on the seventh day, God ended his work which he had made. He rested on the seventh day, and God blessed the seventh day and sanctified it. What does it mean to sanctify something? I went to the dictionary. I thought, I'm not smart enough to figure this out without some help. And Webster says to sanctify is to set something apart for a holy purpose. Well, that's what he did to a day, so we'd never forget how we got here. Now, something goes wrong in this world, and our human parents make a mistake, and our genes are broken. We no longer have that relationship that Eden offered the human race. And God's dream is, I'm going to bring as many of the human race back to a perfect world as I can. And so he selects a man of faith by the name of Abraham. And he says, Abraham, I want to use you and your descendants as special messengers to the world to remind them of these 10 principles. If we would follow them, we could get along with each other better. And buried within the very middle of those 10 principles is this wonderful memorial of creation called the Sabbath day. So on Sinai, God speaks to those descendants who are being led to the crossroads of the world, still the crossroads of the world, to enlighten the world as to what God's ideal is for redemption of the human race. And he speaks to Israel. And what does he say when he talks about the Sabbath? Remember the Sabbath day to keep it holy. Why do you suppose he would say remember it? Because it's been around for 2.5 millennia already. It harks back to Eden. And notice the fourth commandment says, worship him that made heaven and earth, the sea and the fountains of waters. Well, it's almost identical to what you see in Revelation 14:7. So may I suggest respectfully that Revelation 14 predicts not only people who will remind the world of a gospel message, the good news of the judgment, but also the need to remember our Creator on that special memorial day of creation. Today, that a day of worship he established and never changed. You know, I just love Catholic people. I'm a graduate, three-time graduate of Catholic University. My son is too. He has 2 degrees from a Catholic U. I love to talk with priests and women religious. There are wonderful people in the Catholic faith. And what I admire about them is the intellectual honesty that they come up with. I think of that priest, that parish priest up in Michigan at St. Catherine's Parish, who did a newsletter, and he said, the most powerful thing the church, the Catholic Church, ever did was to change the day of worship. So there's nothing in scriptures authorizing that. He said, if you believe that the scripture should be the sole authority, you should logically become a Seventh-day Adventist and keep Sabbath holy. To which I can only say amen. I just love talking with people like that. That's why I love Catholics. So there's a gospel message at the end of time, a judgment hour message, a worship message, reminding us of intelligent design and the day God established so we'd never forget. But there's still more in Revelation 14. Remember, these messages are directed to a world just teetering on the precipice when things really go bad. We talked about that last night, some of the forces that are at play even in today's world that finally drive a frightened world into a globalism where liberty disappears. And so Revelation 14 has some very specific messages for people living in a time of fear when they're apt to make a terrible mistake. And now we go to Revelation 14, 8. And there followed another angel, another agalos, another messenger, saying, Babylon has fallen, that great city, because she made all nations drink of the wine of the wrath of her fornication. Notice the phrase there, all nations. There's your globalism. Last night we talked about it. In every way the Bible can, it symbolizes and illustrates this globe at the end of time will pull together, but it won't be good. So there's all nations making some mistake. And now verse 9 says the third angel followed them, saying with a loud voice, if any man worship the beast and his image and receive his mark, the same shall drink of the wine of the wrath of God. There's an end time message to a world teetering on a terrible mistake. Now, God's faithful believers don't need to fear the judgment. Your heavenly attorney and defense counsel is also your judge. Your salvation is secure. I'll rest my case in him anytime. I think he can argue a pretty good case. But for those who don't follow God, verse 11 of Revelation 14 says, they have no rest day or night who worship the beast in his image. Really important to be on the right side of the cosmic war. Something goes desperately wrong in Revelation 13. All nations are obviously involved, and the Bible colorfully illustrates this with the symbol of Babylon. Now, the question that we might ask is, why on earth use that word to describe an end-time world? Babylon is a prehistoric city. It's millennia back in the past. Might I suggest that if we really want to understand the Bible, we ask ourselves, what went wrong back in Babylon, and are those mistakes the world is capable of making near the end of time? So we go back and we look at Babylon. It appears shortly after Noah's flood. People settle down on that alluvial plain of the Euphrates River, and instead of dispersing, you know, around the world as God intended that they should, they clump together. You know, whenever people get crowded together too much, they reach critical mass and things go bad. The Lord intended for people to spread out, not have that concentration that causes so much trouble. But they concentrated there and built this city called Babylon. Now, what mistakes did they make? They're right by the Euphrates River on the floodplain. It doesn't take Einstein to figure out that if another flood comes, that river's going to come up over the banks and we're going to be, you know, standing in water up to here. So the first thing they do is disbelieve the promises of God. God said, I'll never cover the world with water again. That's over. It won't happen again. First mistake Babylon makes is, well, maybe he will and maybe he won't. But we're not real sure about that. So they disbelieve the promises of God. Now, if you disbelieve God's promises, you've got to believe in something. So who are you going to believe in? All you've got left is yourself. So the next mistake they make is they believe in self. They go down to the Euphrates River where all that nice mud is, that clay, and they start making bricks, and they make them by the billions. They're going to build this tower that'll be so high that even if God changes his mind, doesn't keep his promise, sends another flood, they can walk up to the top of that thing in perfect comfort. Then some bright guy comes along and says, well, no, wait a second. As long as we're building a tower, why don't we just build it clear to heaven? We can walk into heaven on our own. I wrote a book called The Lucifer Diary, and I had a little fun with that one as Lucifer watches these idiots think they're going to build a mud brick tower across the cosmos. Well, anyways, mistake number two then is basically what? We can save ourselves. If you don't believe the promises of God, you got to believe something so you believe in yourself. And the conclusion is, well, we can work our way to heaven. Might I suggest it was that mistake that the elegant ritual of the Hebrew sanctuary service was designed to expose. And when day after day you saw these innocent, beautiful little creatures that had done no wrong at all, symbolically take your sin for you and die before your very eyes, the mind is forced to reflect on the fact someday everything I've done wrong is going to get borne by that great sin bearer who's going to visit our world. Hebrew sanctuary service was designed to prove you can't do it on your own. You're not going to work your way to heaven. So, Babylon makes two catastrophic mistakes, but there's still a third. Centuries go by, and there's this brilliant tactician by the name of Nebuchadnezzar, but he has a problem. He gets a little bit proud. He's accumulated gold from all over the world, including the Hebrew temple and Egypt and other places. He has so much gold, he can commission a statue 90 feet tall and 9 feet across the shoulders made of gold. He erects this thing on the plain of Dura. Then his ego really pumps up and he says, well, you know, this thing is too good just for Babylon. We need to invite the rest of the world in. So he invites leaders from all over the world, North Africa, Asia, probably India, north of the Mediterranean. They all come together. And then he gets the bright idea, well, as long as we're all here, why don't I, you know, get a band together? And when the band starts to play, everybody will have to bow down and worship that image, which basically is a symbol of me. Now, what are we talking about? A world religion enforced by a death decree, because he says if you don't bow down, that smelting furnace over there from which we sculpted this thing is still hot. The bellows still work. We can get flames coming out the mouth of that thing, and in there you go. And people of faith from all ages since have regaled themselves on this story of those three brave Jewish young men who stood erect when the rest of the world bowed. And may I suggest that is what will happen at the end of time. And a proud king looked into the fiery opening on that furnace, and he saw not three but four. And he had heard enough from Daniel to recognize the fourth one was the Son of God. What were the mistakes of ancient Babylon? Don't believe the promises of God, think you can work your way to heaven, and finally have a world religion that you enforce with a death decree. And Revelation 14 spends over half of its verses advising people how to get ready at the end of time, refuting that worldwide mistake. Well, there's still more. There's still one more mighty verse before we reach Revelation's word picture of the second coming. And now we're ready for Revelation 14, verse 12. Revelation 14, 12. Here is the patience of the saints. Here are they that preach the commandments of God. Did I get that right? What do they do? They don't preach the commandments, they keep the commandments, and there is a difference. Now, what have we just said? We've said here is a generation of believers doing the impossible. Because a generation of believers has never done this before. There have been isolated people like Elijah, like Enoch, like holy men and women who did follow the word of God and kept his commandments, never generations the Bible could point to. Suddenly Revelation 14 looks into the future and says, here is a group of people who are keeping the commandments. Well, some people say, you know, that just can't be done. And for proof, they point to the sorry history, even of Christian believers who were fully capable of singing about the gospel on Sunday while breaking their treaties with Native Americans. You following me? Or singing about the gospel on Sunday while enslaving Africans. And the non-believer looks at that and says, your songs are pretty and your words are nice, but you aren't delivering the message. And those people would say the history of the Christian faith is such it proves it's impossible to do this. And to them I reply, maybe our generation won't do it, but somebody will. How do I know? Because the Bible says it. If the Bible predicts it, you can take it to the bank. There will be people who will keep the commandments of God. Revelation clearly predicts it, but the question is, how do they do that? Because that level of victory generational victory hasn't been very often seen, if ever, in this world. So how do these people keep the commandments of God? Well, fortunately, we don't have to try to figure that out for ourselves, because the Bible answers it. Revelation 14:12 isn't done yet. All you have to do is go on reading. Here are they that keep the commandments of God, and there's something else here. And what? Hath the faith of Jesus. That, I respectfully suggest, is how these people keep the commandments of God. They have the faith of Jesus. Now, we could stop right now and piously nod and have failed to do the most important thing of all, and that is define our terms. What exactly is the faith of Jesus? What do these people somehow get a hold of that enables something generationally that has never been done in the history of the world? Might I suggest the faith of Jesus is something we need to do our own biblical research on. What was my suggestion? Don't get your answer from a commentator or a commentary. Go back to the Word, and when you start your Bible research, go where? Go to the cross. Start there. The chances are you'll find your answer. May I suggest you find the answer there as to what the faith of Jesus was? Now, he's hanging there on the cross. Everything is hurting. It hurts so bad to speak, because to get air out of your lungs when you're being crucified, you have to pull on those hands, push on feet that are just hurting terribly in order to even breathe out. When your arms go up, the process of respiration is reversed. Normally, we breathe in. It takes a little work to get air in. Getting air out of your lungs is no problem. But in crucifixion, the intercostal spaces between your ribs have expanded. Your lungs have expanded. You have to work to get the air out. I'm convinced most people died of crucifixion after several days. They just finally asphyxiated in their own CO2 because they couldn't breathe out anymore. Jesus is on the cross. He only speaks 7 times during 6 hours because it hurt too much to say very much. But now he's on the cross. He pushes with those feet that are hurting, pulls on the arms that are hurting terribly, and he screams into the record of human history the admission he can't see the Father anymore. My God, where have you gone? Now he's really alone, or seems to be. He leaves in the record of human history his admission he can't see the Father anymore. Now it's as if he's over a black hole. Nothing there. It's as if he's going into the second death for us. Subjectively, his humanity can no longer see the Father. But what's the very next thing he says? Once again, he pulls on those hurting arms and he evokes enough language into the stream of the historical record. We know exactly what's in his mind. Having admitted he can't see the Father anymore, he prays to the Father he can't see. That, I respectfully suggest, is the faith of Jesus. He just turns loose of life, drops into a blackness his humanity can't see the end of, trusting someplace there will be the Father's arms. That's beautifully dealt with in a book by a fine Christian writer entitled Desire of Ages. You read about the sufferings of Christ in that book, Desire of Ages, and you will get a word picture there that really helps us to understand what the faith of Jesus is. Even when we can't see the Father, when it seems as though there's nothing left on earth, we turn loose of our last grip on this earth. We drop into the unknown, trusting the Father's arms will be there. And may I suggest, that is how this generation described in Revelation 14 keeps the commandments. Heaven has a message for those who face the kind of world we're living in today. Terrorism and economic trouble and a decaying society and a decaying family. There's nothing in our future which needs to surprise us. Through the view prophecy gives us, we have seen the future before it happens, and when it happens, we can be ready. And now we close with the promise that a generation who exercises that kind of faith in Jesus and of Jesus will fulfill the mighty prophecy of Revelation 14:12. And Jesus told his disciples, at that time, the Son of Man will appear in the sky, and he will send his angels with a loud trumpet call, and they will gather his elect from the four winds, from one end of the heavens to the other. When you see all these things, you know it is near. Therefore, Jesus said, keep watch.
You have been listening to another special American Christian Ministries presentation. This is a digital recording for optimum sound quality. International copyright, all rights reserved. To order a copy of this or other presentations, or for a free catalog, please call toll-free 800-233-4450. International calls dial 717-652-7000. You may also order from our secure website at www.americanchristianministry.org. There you will discover the largest selection of authentic Adventist preaching available. You can trust ACM. There's no compromise here. If American Christian Ministries has been a blessing to you, why not take a moment just now and send us a note or an email with your testimony? We'll share it with the speakers and volunteer workers to encourage them. Your prayers and continual financial support are very important to ensure the continuation of this ministry as we help prepare America and the world to meet Jesus Christ. He is coming soon.